Collegiate. Congratulations, that's excellent. Well, Ryan's a very special little boy. Yes, that would be great. I know Grayer would love to go to school with Ryan. Yes, dinner would be lovely. Oh, the four of us? I'll have to check my husband's schedule. Let's talk after the weekend. Great. Bye. She takes a deep breath and clenches her jaw. Where was I? Grayer's expectations? Oh, yes. I'm concerned that your encouragement of his fixation on collegiate may have set him up for a potentially deleterious self-esteem adjustment. No, please. Don't feel bad. It's really my fault for allowing you to do it. I should have been more on top of you. She sighs and shakes her head. But I spoke to my pediatrician this morning, and he suggested a long-term development consultant who specializes in coaching parents and caregivers through this transition. She'll be coming by tomorrow while Grayer's in piano, and she's asked to speak with you separately to assess your role in his development. Great. That sounds like a good idea. I go through the doorway. I stick my head back in. Should I not let him wear it today? What? She reaches for her coffee. The sweatshirt? Oh. Well, he can wear it today, and then we'll let the consultant tell us how to handle this situation tomorrow. Okay, great. I go back out to where Grayer, seated in the banquette, is watching Connie polish the stove, while absentmindedly playing with a tie around his neck, and wonder if perhaps we're not focusing on the wrong piece of apparel. I sit in the chair next to Mrs. X's desk, waiting for the consultant, and surreptitiously try to read, upside down, the notes scrawled on Mrs. X's notepad. Even though it's probably nothing more than a glorified grocery list, the fact that I have been left alone in here makes me feel as if I should be covert. If I had a hidden camera in a button on my sweater, I would frantically try to photograph everything on the desk. I'm starting to make myself laugh at the idea of it when the woman enters, briefcase first. Nanny! She reaches out to firmly shake my hand. I'm Jane. Jane Gould. How are you today? She speaks just a little too loudly, eyeing me over her glasses as she puts her briefcase down on Mrs. X's desk. Fine, thanks. How are you? I am suddenly very cheerful and also a little too loud. Just fine, thank you for asking. She crosses her arms over her cranberry-colored blazer and nods rhythmically at me. She has very big lips made up in the exact same cranberry, bleeding into the lines around her mouth. I nod back at her. She looks down at her watch. So, Nanny, I'm just going to get my pad out here and we'll get started. She proceeds to mention each action as she does it until she's seated in Mrs. X's chair, pen poised. Nanny, our objective over the course of the next 45 minutes is to assess Grayer's perceptions and expectations. I would like you to share with me the understanding you currently hold of your role and responsibilities surrounding Grayer's critical path with regard to the next stratum of his schooling. Okay, I say, replaying her statement in my head to locate the question. Nanny, in your first quarter at the X residence, how would you characterize your performance in relation to Grayer's academic activity? Good. I mean, I was picking him up from school, but honestly, there wasn't a lot of academic activity to... I see. So you do not consider yourself an active... dynamic participant in his process. How would you describe your agenda during his scheduled playtime? Right. Grayer really likes to play trains. Oh, and dress up, so I try to do activities that he enjoys. I wasn't aware that he had an agenda for playtime. Do you engage him in puzzles? He doesn't like puzzles so much. Math problems? He's a little young. When was the last time you practiced circles? I'm sure sometime in the last week we had the crayons out. Do you play the Suzuki tapes? Only when he takes a bath. Have you been reading to him from the Wall Street Journal? Well, actually, The Economist? Not really. The Financial Times? Should I be? She sighs heavily and scribbles furiously on her pad. She begins again. How many bilingual meals are you serving him a week?
We speak French on Tuesday night, but I usually serve veggie burgers.
And you are attending the Guggenheim on what basis?
We go to the Museum of Natural History. He loves the rocks.
What methodology are you following to dress him?
He picks out his clothes, or Mrs. X does. As long as he'll be comfortable,
you don't utilize an apparel chart, then?
Not really.
And I suppose you're not documenting his choices with him on a closet diagram?
Yeah, no.
Nor are you having him translate his color and sizes into the Latin?
Maybe later this year? She looks back at me and nods for a while. I shift in my seat and smile. She leans across the desk and takes off her glasses.
Nanny, I'm going to have to raise a flag here.
Okay. I lean in to meet her.
I have to question whether you're leveraging your assets to escalate Grayer's performance.
Having let the cat out of the bag, she leans back and rests her hands in her lap. I sense that I should feel insulted. Leverage my assets? Anyone?
I'm sorry to hear that, I say earnestly, as the one thing abundantly clear is that I should be feeling sorry. Nanny, I understand you're getting your degree in arts and education, so frankly, I'm surprised by the lack of depth surrounding your knowledge base here.
Okay, now I know I'm insulted.
Well, Jane, she straightens at the sound of her name, I am trained to work with children who have far fewer resources at their disposal than Grayer. I see. So you don't perceive this opportunity to be in an arena in which you are a value add?
What? I want to add value to Grayer, but he's really stressed out right now. She looks skeptically at me.
Stressed? Yes, he's stressed. And I am only an undergrad here, Jane, so I'm sure you'll take this with a grain of salt. The best thing I can give him is some downtime so that his imagination can grow without being forced in one direction or another. Blood rushes to my face, and I know I've gone too far, but being made to feel like an idiot by yet another middle-aged woman in this office is just a bit more than I can handle. She scribbles a few notes and smiles evenly at me.
Well, Nanny, I advise you to integrate time for reflection as you continue to work with Grayer. Here are a series of best practices from other caregivers that I suggest you review and internalize. This is explicit knowledge, Nanny, explicit knowledge from your peers that must become tacit for you if Grayer is to reach his optimal state.
She hands me a bunch of papers with a big clip at the top and stands, sliding her glasses back on. I stand up, too, feeling I need somehow to clean this up. I didn't mean to seem defensive. I care very deeply for Grayer and follow all of Mrs. X's instructions. The past few months he's insisted on the collegiate sweatsuit almost every day, and Mrs. X even got him a few more so he would have one to wear when the others were in the wash. So I just want to be sure that you know I...
She puts out her hand for me to shake. Right. Thank you for your time this afternoon, Nanny.
I shake her hand. Yes, thank you. I'll read these through tonight. I'm sure they'll be very helpful.
Come on, Grove, finish up so we can go play a game.
Grayer has been pushing around his last tortellini for about 5 minutes. Thanks to Jane, it's already been a long afternoon for both of us. I look down at him, resting his blonde head on his arm and staring horizontally at the last of his dinner.
What's the matter? Not hungry?
No.
I reach for his plate. No!
He grabs the edge, causing his fork to drop to the table.
Okay, Grayer, just say, Nanny, I'm not finished. I can wait.
I sit back down.
Nanny! Mrs. X comes bustling in. Nanny!
She's about to speak when she sees Grayer and the lone tortellini.
Did you have a good dinner, Grayer?
Yes, he says, into his arm. But she's already focused her attention back to me.
Could you come out here for a minute?
I follow her into the dining room where she turns and stops so abruptly I accidentally step on her foot. "I'm sorry, are you okay?" She grimaces. "I'm fine." "I just finished with Jane, and it's paramount that we have a family meeting to break the news to Grayer together about the REJECTION. So, I'll need you to call Mr. X's office and find out when he could be scheduled to attend. The number's in the pantry." "Mrs. X?" Jane calls as she comes into the hall. "Sure, no problem. Right away." I quickly slip back into the kitchen. Grayer is still making slow circles with his fork, the tortellini in orbit. I hover over him for a moment while listening to Jane and Mrs. X in the hallway. "Yes, I've just spoken with Nanny. I'm going to see how soon my husband can come home for this meeting," Mrs. X says, waxing professional. "His presence is really unnecessary, as long as Grayer perceives his primary caregiver to be present. You should just go ahead and speak with him yourself." Jane's voice moves toward the front door, and I head for the phone. "Mr. X's office, Justine speaking. How may I help you?" "Justine? Hi, it's Nanny." "Hi, how are you?" she asks over the din of a printer. "Hanging in there. How about you?" "Busy," she sighs. "The merger is making things crazy around here. I haven't been home before midnight in 2 weeks." "That sucks." "Well, hopefully Mr. X will get a huge retention bonus and spread a little of it around." "Don't count on it." "So, is Mrs. X liking the flowers?" "What?" "The roses. I thought it was overkill, but Mr. X just told me to put in a standing order."
"Yeah, it kind of feels like a standing order," I confirm.
"I'll make sure tomorrow's bouquet has more variety. What's her favorite flower?"
"She likes peonies," I whisper as Mrs. X breezes past Grayer to stand in front of me, expectantly.
"Where am I going to find peonies in March?" Justine sighs again as the printer makes a clacking sound. "Ugh, I can't believe this thing is broken again. Sorry, never mind, I'll do it. Anything else?" "Oh, right. Mrs. X wants to schedule a family meeting about..." I glance over her shoulder at the pasta pusher. "The little one? When could he be here?"
"Let's see, I could push a meeting up..." I can hear her flipping pages.
"Ta-ta-ta, yeah, I can get him back to New York by Wednesday at 4. I'll have him there."
"Great, thanks, Justine. Anytime."
I hang up the phone and turn to her. "Justine said that he can be here Wednesday at 4.
"Well, if that's really the soonest he can make it, I guess that will have to do."
She glances down to adjust her sparkling engagement ring. "Jane said it was crucial that he be here, so..."
"Right."
"I mean, the Wall Street Journal? He's 4!
"Jesus," my dad exclaims just as Sophie pushes her nose between our legs. "Your mom still wants you out of there."
"I can handle it."
I jog forward a few steps and Sophie circles, ready for her next run. And there's no way I could leave Grayer right now.
Dad runs to the bottom of the hill. "Sophie, come on!"
Sophie looks confused.
"Over here!" he calls.
Sophie turns 180 degrees from my heels and takes off in his direction against a cold gust of wind that blows her ears even farther back. As soon as she reaches him, running just below his gloved hands, I call to her and she gallops back up toward me, and then the two of us run down the slope until we are beside him on the main promenade that runs along the uptown stretch of Riverside Park.
"Ready for your interview tomorrow?"
Sophie rolls into his shins in an effort to catch up.
"I'm kind of nervous, but Professor Clarkson's been practicing with us in class. I'd really like to have my job for next year lined up soon."
I hunch my shoulders against another gust of cold wind.
"You'll knock 'em dead. Go along!"
I run back up the hill toward the edge of the trees and look back down just as the streetlight turns on, making it appear darker around us. I look up into the yellow glow, composing a wish along the lines of starlight, starbright.
"Oh, electric gods of the tri-state area, I'm just wishing for a real, honest-to-goodness job with set hours and an office where the boss's underwear isn't drying in the bathroom. Someday I'd like to be able to help more than one child at a time, children who don't come accessorized with their own consultants. Thank you. Amen. The subway car is suddenly flooded with sunlight as we surface high over the streets of the South Bronx. I feel that twinge of excitement I always do when a train car moves above ground, flying over the city on its skinny rails like an amusement park ride. I pull my lesson plan out of my backpack and stare at it for the millionth time. The opportunity to join a conflict resolution team for city schools is exactly the kind of job I've been training for. Plus, it would be good to work with teenagers and take a break from the tiny folk. The train pulls to a stop, and I step out into the cold sunshine. I make my way down the steps of the platform to the street and discover that I am not 4 blocks away from my interview, but 14. I must have misunderstood the woman on the phone. I check my watch, picking up the pace. I was too nervous this morning to have breakfast, but the 90-minute trek has revived my appetite. I walk/run down the long streets, knowing I should eat or risk passing out mid-lesson. Fully out of breath, I run into a tiny newspaper stand, grab a bag of peanuts, and stuff them in my backpack. One door down, I ring the buzzer next to a taped piece of hand-colored paper that reads, "Communities Against Conflict." A voice blares unintelligibly out through the static, and the door clicks, letting me into a stairwell, once painted green, and lined with posters of children in playgrounds looking gravely into the camera. I examine each print as I climb the stairs, and judging by the haircuts and bell-bottoms, guess these are promo posters circa the early 70s, around the time that this organization was founded. I buzz again at the top step, and am greeted by loud barking before a large hand pulls the door slightly ajar.
"Snowflake, stay! Stay!"
"I'm here for an interview," I say, looking around for another door, assuming I've mistakenly interrupted a resident in the building. A pale woman's face appears in the crack.
"Yeah? Communities Against Conflict, you're in the right place. Come on in. Just be careful of Snowflake. He's always trying to free himself."
I shimmy through the small opening she's made in the door and practically come face to face with a humongous black shepherd and the rest of an equally large woman in overalls and waist-length graying blonde hair. I smile, bending down to pet Snowflake, who is trying to get past her widely planted legs.
"No!"
she screams.
I jolt up. "He's not really a people person, are you, Snowflake?"
She pats the dog gruffly on his head with her free hand, as the other holds a stack of manila folders. Having adequately warned me, she lets Snowflake check me out while I stay perfectly still.
"I'm Rena, the executive director of communities. You are..."
She fixes me with an intense stare. I try to get a read on her, attempting to figure out who she would like me to be. "Nan? I think I was supposed to meet with Richard?" I aim for solid and warm, without a hint of cheerful.
"Nan? I thought your name was Naminia. Shit. Richard!"
Rena bellows at me and I almost duck. She turns back to her files.
"He'll be here in a minute. Richard!"
She screams again, this time into the filing cabinet. "Okay, I'll just have a seat." I try to demonstrate that I am someone who can take care of herself, as I sense independence is of value here. I turn around to discover that the two chairs designated to the few feet serving as a waiting area are both piled with overflowing boxes of yellowing brochures. I opt for standing by the wall and getting out of Rena's way, as this seems to be a community's value as well. A door flies open at the far side of the room, and a man with a pasty complexion, who looks related to Rena, and whom I presume to be Richard, emerges. He squints at me in his glasses, breathing heavily with the effort of getting around her and the dog to greet me. He is sweating profusely and has a wilted cigarette stuck behind his ear.
"Naminia?" "Nan," Rena grunts over a file.
"Oh, Nan. I'm Richard, the artistic director."
"Well, I see you've met Rena and Snowflake. Why don't we get right to it? Let's go into the feelings room and get you set up."
He shakes my hand and exchanges glances with Rena. I follow him to the feelings room, which is about the same size as the office, but without all the desks.
"So, have a seat there, Nan."
I do, ready to tell my whole wonderful story, ready to knock 'em dead.
Now let me tell you about myself, Richard begins.
He leans back in the plastic folding chair and proceeds to explain about his decades spent in social work, how he met up with Rena at a rally against the superintendent, their years traveling the globe to gather methodologies for conflict resolution, and the host of virtually thousands of kids that he has personally trained to make the world a better place. He also goes on extensively about his misguided childhood, the illegitimate son who doesn't call him anymore, and his recent attempts to quit smoking. I zone in and out, keeping a beaming smile on my face and developing a fixation on the peanuts in my bag. About an hour later, he finally says,
"So I see here that you are minoring in gender studies. What does that mean?"
He scans the resume I faxed in, squinting to read the blurred print. I follow his gaze to the top of the page to discover that I am Naminia of 4-ish East 90th something Street. Ah, Naminia. Well, I'm in the home stretch of a major in child development, and I was very interested in supplementing this work.
So you're not a feminist bitch, then?
He has a good, hearty laugh, taking a Kleenex out of his pocket and wiping down his forehead. I attempt a weak laugh. As I was saying, I've been completing my thesis with Professor Clarkson and have been interning this semester at an after-school program in Brooklyn.
Right, so let's get you up and running. Let me grab Rena and we'll get you started with your session.
He stands. Rena! Loud barking ensues in the other room. I pull my lesson plan out of my backpack while Snowflake bursts in, followed by Rena. I walk to the other side of the room and write my notes on the rolling blackboard. I take a deep breath. I have prepared a session on peer pressure for 14-year-olds in grade 9. As you'll see on the board here, I have written these key terms. I would begin by asking the group to work together to construct, "Teacher! Teacher!" Richard is waving wildly from the back of the room. "I'm sorry, are you not ready for me to start?" I ask, unsure of what is happening. He balls up a piece of paper and throws it at Rena, who starts to mock cry.
"Teacher, Rena said a bad word!"
Rena continues to boo-hoo, causing Snowflake to circle her, barking. "I'm sorry, Richard. It was my understanding that we were just doing an interview." But they are in their own world, throwing paper at each other and fake crying. I clear my throat. "Okay, the session you asked me to prepare was for teenagers, but I can modify it for preschoolers." I glance at my notes and frantically try to downscale the plan for a different age group. I turn back to face two huge adults and one huge dog hiding behind chairs and launching paper.
Excuse me? Excuse me?
Okay, class!
I say loudly, giving sway to my frustration. They turn back to me. Rena stands up, breaking character.
"How are you feeling right now, Nan?"
"Sorry?" I ask. Richard gets out his notebook.
"How do you feel about us in this moment? What does your gut say?"
They look at me expectantly. "Well, I think perhaps I misunderstood the directives."
"Shit, Nan! Do you have rage in there? Do you hate us? We're just not feeling the love. I want to hear it from you. How is your relationship with your mother?"
"Rena, frankly, I'm unclear how this relates to my abilities to..." Rena puts her hands on her large hips and Snowflake circles her heels.
"We're a family here. There are no boundaries in the feelings room. You've got to come in here with trust and love and just go for it. Here's the thing, Nan. We're really not looking to hire white women right now."
She is so comfortable with this statement that I'm tempted to ask how many openings they have for white feminist bitches. Even more bizarre, why a person of color might have a better time discussing their maternal issues with complete strangers, white strangers nonetheless. Richard stands, soaked with sweat and coughing a smoker's cough.
"We have just gotten way too many resumes from white girls. You don't speak Korean, do you?"
I shake my head, speechless.
Nan, we're trying to model diversity here to represent an ideal community.
Snowflake, heal!
Snowflake wanders back from where he has been sniffing around my bag. He passes me with his head down, swallowing the last of my peanuts. I look at both of their very white faces against the backdrop of bright rainbows painted on the peeling wall behind them. Well, thank you for the opportunity. You have a very interesting organization here. I quickly gather my things. They walk me to the door.
Yeah, maybe next semester we'll be doing some fundraising work on the East Side. Would you be interested in that?
I picture introducing Rena to Mrs. X at the Met so she can ask her about her rage. I'm really looking for field work right now. Thanks, though. I get out the door and go directly to Burger King for an extra large fries and a Coke. Folded into an immobile red seat, I sigh deeply. Comparing Rena and Richard with Jane and Mrs. X, somewhere out there must be people who believe in a middle ground between demanding children to feel their rage and overprogramming children so everyone can pretend they don't have any. I take a long sip of my soda. Apparently, I'm not going to be finding it anytime soon.
See, if I have two jelly beans and you have one jelly bean, together we have three jelly beans.
I hold out the jelly beans to make my point.
I like the white ones and the ones that taste like banana. How do they do that, Nanny? How do they make it taste like banana?
Grayer lines up the colored candy like railroad tracks on his bedroom carpet.
I don't know, G. Maybe they mush up a banana, and they mush up the jelly, and then they mush it all together and cook it in a bean shape.
Yeah, a bean shape.
So much for math.
Nanny, try this one.
Yesterday's peony arrangement came with a grayer-sized tin of jelly beans.
How about the green ones? How do they make those?
We both hear the door slam. Only 3 hours late. Not bad.
Daddy!
He runs out of the room and I follow into the hall.
Hey, sport, where's your mother?
He pats Grayer on the head while loosening his tie. Here I am, she says, and we all turn. She is wearing a powder blue pencil skirt, kitten heels, a cashmere V-neck sweater, eyeshadow, mascara, and blush. Va-voom. If this were the first time my husband had been home in 3 weeks, I'd get dolled up, too. She smiles shakily beneath her rose lipstick.
Well, let's get this started,
he says, barely glancing at her before heading to the living room where Jane left her charts and diagrams. Grayer and his mother scamper in behind Mr. X, and I am left behind in the front hall. I take a seat on the bench, resuming my role as lady-in-waiting.
Darling, Mrs. X begins with a bit too much enthusiasm. Shall I have Connie get you a drink? Or perhaps some coffee? Connie!
I jump about 3 feet, and Connie comes flying out of the kitchen, her hands still wet.
Jesus, do you have to be so shrill?
No, I just ate, Mr. X says. Connie stops just short of entering the room. We exchange glances, and I make room for her on the bench.
Oh, all right. So, Grayer, Mommy and Daddy want to talk to you about where you're going to school next year.
Mrs. X attempts a second opening.
I'm going to collegiate, Grayer offers, trying to be helpful.
No, sweetie. Mommy and Daddy have decided that you are going to St. Bernard's.
Bernard? He asks.
There is a moment of silence.
Can we play trains now? Daddy, I got a new train. It's red.
So, sweetie, you can't wear the blue sweatshirt anymore, okay?
She says. Connie rolls her eyes at me.
Why?
Because it says collegiate on it, and you're going to St. Bernard's, Mr. X says with exasperation.
But I like it.
Yes, sweetie, we'll get you a St. Bernard's sweatshirt. I like the blue one.
I lean in and whisper to Connie, Oh, for the love of God, let him wear it inside out. Who cares? She throws her hands up. Mrs. X clears her throat.
Okay, sweetie, we'll talk about this later.
Connie disappears back into the kitchen.
Daddy, come see my trains. I'll show you the new one. It's red and really, really fast.
Grayer flies past me toward his room. That was a complete waste of time. He clearly could care less, Mr. X says.
Well, Jane felt it was important, she retorts defensively.
Who the hell is Jane?
He asks.
Look, do you have the slightest idea of what it means to be in the middle of a merger? I don't have time for this.
I'm sorry, but do I have to be on top of everything? He growls.
The one thing I delegated to you was his schooling, and now it's all fucked up.
It was a very competitive year, she cries. Grayer doesn't play the violin.
What the fuck does the violin have to do with anything?
Maybe if you'd spend an hour of your precious time with us, he might have done better in his interviews, she spits back.
My precious time? My precious time? I am bashing my brains out 80 hours a week so you can stand there in your pearls with your $8,000 curtains and your charity work and question how I spend my time? Who's going to pay his tuition bills, huh? You?
Honey, she softens, I know you're under a lot of pressure. Look, since you're already home, why don't we talk about it over a nice, relaxing dinner? I made a reservation at that place you love, down by the river.
Her kitten heels make little clicks as she walks over to him. Her voice drops.
We could get a room at the Pierre, maybe the one with the double jacuzzi bath. I've really missed you.
It's quiet for a minute, and then I distinctly hear the sound of them kissing. Their low laughter drifts into the hallway. I'm just about to sneak off to Grayer's room when Mrs. X coos,
Should I send a donation to St. Bernard's with the tuition check so we get off on the right foot with them?
The right foot?
He's again indignant.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but haven't they already accepted him?
But if we have another boy...
Look, I've got to get back to the office. The car's waiting downstairs. I'll call you later. Mr. X swiftly passes me, still wearing the overcoat he presumably never took off. The door slams loudly behind him.
Daddy? Wait!
Grayer comes running out with his red train.
Daddy!
He throws himself screaming against the front door. Mrs. X walks slowly into the hall and stands for a moment, glaring through Grayer at the front door until her eyes glaze over, then walks right past both of us to her bedroom.
Daddy!
He convulses with sobs, bending over while holding tightly onto the doorknob.
I want Daddy!
I sit down on the floor and reach out to hold him. He drops his head between his dangling arms and away from me.
No! I want my daddy!
We hear the elevator door slide closed.
Don't leave!
Shh, I know. I circle my arms to pull him onto my lap. I know, Grove. We sit on the floor as his tears make a dark, wet spot on the knee of my jeans. I rub his back and murmur, It's okay, Grove. Shh. It's okay to be sad. We'll just sit here and be sad for a little while.
Okay,
he says into my pant leg. Okay. Part 3. Spring. Mammy had her own method of letting her owners know exactly where she stood on all matters. She knew it was beneath the dignity of quality white folks to pay the slightest attention to what a darkie said, even when she was just grumbling to herself. She knew that to uphold this dignity, they must ignore what she said, even if she stood in the next room and almost shouted, Gone with the Wind. Chapter 8. Frosting on the Cake. Connie.
Rather than ironing Grayer's sheets today, I'd like you to pack the following items for Mr. X. His suits, shirts, ties, underwear, socks, and anything else he uses. These items should be packed and down with the doorman by 3 o'clock. Please see that you only use his luggage. See monogram.
Nanny,
Have you seen Grayer's bow tie? I put it out last night. Mrs. X and Grayer are due at the April tea for new St. Bernard's families in 20 minutes. Mrs. X is rummaging through Grayer's drawers while I try to wrestle him into an ultra-starched Oxford, complete with stays in the collar, and Connie, I assume, is somewhere in Mr. X's closet filling his monogrammed luggage. I need an elephant, Grayer says, pointing to the sketch pad on his diminutive table. One second, Grayer, I say. Let me buckle your belt. No, not that one. She sticks her head out from Grayer's walk-in closet. That's the one you put out, I add. On the bed. Sorry. It doesn't go. Kneeling down in front of him, I look him over. Blue pinstriped shirt, khaki pants, white socks, brown belt. I don't see the problem, but I unbuckle him. Here, she says, handing me a green and red striped canvas belt. I point down at the belt buckle. See? G, for Grayer.
G,
he asks, looking down. I need my card. I reach for the bus pass holder on the dresser, which contains the vestiges of Mr. X's business card. No, she says, emerging from the closet. Not today. It's like the interviews. Remember the interviews? No card. I want my card. You can keep it in your pocket like a secret agent, I say, tucking it out of sight. I still can't find his effing bow tie. Nanny, I need an elephant. I pick up a gray crayon and draw an amorphous blob with big ears and a trunk, the extent of my artistic expertise. She starts throwing ties out of the closet. I want to wear my tie, he says, referring to the one that hangs to the floor. No, not today. She goes storming out into the entrance hall where I can hear her voice echo off the marble. Connie? Connie? Yes, Mum. Grayer is quiet. I keep my crayon in motion. I have just spent half an hour looking for Grayer's bow tie. Do you happen to know where it is? No, Mum. Is it too much to ask that you keep track of Grayer's clothes? Do I have to be on top of everything? The one thing I delegate to you. She sighs heavily, and then there's a moment of silence. Why are you standing there? Go look for it. I'm sorry. I just don't know where it could be, Mom. I put it in his room with the other ones. Well, it's not there. And this is the second time that a piece of Grayer's clothing has gone missing this month. Now, if you're feeling that this is all too much responsibility for you, I'm sure we can rethink your role here. No, Mom. I look for it. It's just that the clothes need to be packed by 3, and it's 2:30 now. If Mr. X needs them... Are you questioning who you work for? You work for me, and I am telling you to look for the tie. And if this confuses you, please let me know, because as far as I can recall, I am the one who pays you. I stand up shakily and start going through Grayer's closet myself. He comes and stands beside me, leaning his head against my hip. Connie joins us in Grayer's room, pulling the closet door further open. Connie, I'll look here, I say softly. You take the laundry room. As she crosses back through the front hall, Mrs. X continues. We could call Mr. X and see which he gives more of a shit about, whether his clothes get packed or whether his son has the right fucking tie to wear to his new school. Maybe he'll talk to you. Maybe he'll take your call, Connie. I'm sorry, Mom. 5 minutes of thorough, breathless searching uncovers nothing. Anything? Mrs. X's face appears where she has lifted the dust ruffle. No, sorry, I say, from under Grayer's bed. God damn it! Grayer, come on, we have to go. Just put him in the one with the green polka dots. I slide out on my stomach. I want my daddy's tie. He tries to reach for the peg where his father's tie hangs. No, G, you can wear it later. I gently pull his hand away, trying to motivate him toward the door. I want it now. He starts to sob, red blotches appearing on his face. Shh, please, Grove. I kiss his damp cheek and he stands still, tears making their way down into the starched collar. I straighten the knot and go to take him in my arms, but he pushes me away.
No!
And he runs out of the room.
Nanny!
Mrs. X calls, shrilly.
Yes?
I walk to the hall.
We'll be back at 4, in time for ice skating. Connie?
She shakes her head as Connie emerges from the laundry room, as if she is simply too disgusted and disappointed to speak.
I just don't know what to say.
It seems to me we are having these sorts of problems on a regular basis now, and I need you to do some serious thinking about your commitment level to this job. Mrs. X's cell phone emits a sharp ring.
Hello?
She answers while motioning for me to help her on with her mink.
Oh, hi, Justine. Yes, they'll be down by 3. Yes, you can tell him she's packed everything.
She walks away from us into the vestibule.
Oh, Justine, could you see that I get his room number at the Yale Club? In case Grayer has an emergency and I need to get a hold of him.
Well, why would I call you? She takes a deep breath.
Well, I'm glad you see that doesn't make any sense. Frankly, I don't want your apology. What I want is my husband's phone number. I refuse to discuss this with you.
She slams her cell phone closed with such force that it drops to the marble floor. Both women kneel to grab the phone just as the elevator door opens, but Mrs. X gets there first. With a shaking hand, she picks it up and drops it into her clutch. She puts her other hand to the floor to steady herself, her icy blue eyes even with Connie's brown ones.
We seem to be unable to communicate, Connie, she hisses through clenched teeth. So let me be crystal clear. I want you to gather your things and get out of my house. I want you out of my house. That's what I want.
She stands with a shake of her mink and pushes a stunned Grayer into the elevator as the door closes. Connie pulls herself up by the foyer table and walks past me back into the apartment. I take a moment to collect myself before slowly shutting the front door. I walk through the kitchen and find Connie standing with her back to me in the maid's room, her broad shoulders quivering in the small space.
God, Connie, are you okay? I ask quietly in the doorway.
She turns to me, her pain and outrage so rawly palpable on her face that I'm struck silent. She slumps down on the old tweed fold-out couch and undoes the top button of her white uniform.
I've been here 12 years, she says, shaking her head. I was here before her, and I thought I'd be here after.
Do you want something to drink? I ask, stepping into the narrow gap between the couch and the ironing board. Some juice, maybe? I could try to get into the liquor cabinet.
She wants me to leave. She wants me to leave.
I sit down on Mrs. X's steamer trunk.
I've wanted to leave since the first day she got here,
she snorts, reaching for a half-iron T-shirt and wiping her eyes.
Let me tell you something. When they went to Layford, whatever, I didn't get paid. I never get paid when they go away. Not my fault they're on vacation. I'm not on vacation. I still have 3 kids and plenty of bills to pay. And this year, she asked him to declare me. They never declare me. Where am I supposed to come up with that kind of money now? I had to borrow money from my mother to pay all these taxes.
She sits back and pulls off her apron.
When Mrs. X and Grayer flew to the Bahamas last year, and I was going there too, to see my family, she made me fly with them. Grayer spilled juice all over himself at takeoff. And she didn't have a change for him? And he's sitting there, cold and wet and crying, and she just pull on that sleep thing over her eyes and ignore him the whole flight. And I didn't get paid for that. Oh, was I mad. That's why I'm not a nanny.
You ever hear about Jackie?
I shake my head.
Jackie was his baby nurse. but she stayed till Grayer was 2.
What happened to her?
Well, she got a boyfriend. That's what happened to her.
I look at her quizzically.
For 2 years, she just worked. She'd only been here maybe a few years and didn't have too many friends, so she practically lived here, and she and Mrs. X got on okay. I think they got together about Mr. X traveling and Jackie dating no one special, you know, man troubles. But then, Jackie met someone. He looked like Bob Marley. And now, she can't work Friday nights, and she don't like to work the weekend if the exes don't be in Connecticut. So Mrs. X starts in with how inconvenienced she is. But really, she jealous. Jackie had that glow, you know? She had that look about her, and Mrs. X couldn't stand it. So she fired her. Nearly broke Grayer's heart. After that, he was like a little devil child. Wow. I take a deep breath. Oh, you ain't heard the bad part. Jackie called me 6 months later. She couldn't get a new job because Mrs. X wouldn't give her a reference. You know, no reference. They think Jackie stole or something. So she got 2 years missing on her resume, and the agency didn't want to send her out no more. She stands up and wipes her hand slowly down her skirt. That woman is pure evil. They have 6 nannies in 4 months before Caitlin. No one stayed. And one got fired for giving him a corn muffin in the park. Don't you never feed him if you want to keep your job, you hear? And Mr. X keeps porn in his shoe closet, the nasty kind. I'm trying to take this all in.
Connie, I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry for me. She tosses the crumpled t-shirt onto the couch and marches with purpose into the kitchen. You just watch out for yourself.
I follow her. She opens one of the empty, delft cookie jars on the counter and pulls out a handful of black lace, slamming it down on the table in front of me.
Panties. And I found these under the bed.
Right under the bed? I can't help asking. She tilts her head down at me.
Mm-hmm. Now he's got the other one running all around here, acting like she owns the place. It took me 2 days to get the stink of her perfume out of here before Mrs. X got back.
Should somebody tell her? Do you think somebody should tell Mrs. X about this woman? I ask, dizzy with relief at finally being able to consult a colleague.
Now you listen here. Ain't you been here for the last hour? It's not my problem, and don't you make it your problem either. It's none of our business.
Now, you better pack up Mr. X's things. I gotta get out of here. She reaches around and unties her apron, dropping it onto the counter.
So what are you gonna do?
Oh, my sister, she works up the block. She always knows people who are looking for housekeepers and whatnot. I'll find something.
It'll be less money, if that's possible. But I'll find something. I always do. She walks into the maid's room to collect her things, leaving me staring down at the black silk thong screaming like profane graffiti against the peach marble table.
Nanny, today you have a play date with Carter after tennis. Please be there by 3. The Miltons live at 10 East 67th Street, and I think you'll be staying for supper. I'm having dinner at Bolo. I still can't find Grayer's bow tie. Did you take it home? Please check. Thanks.
Grayer is still crying when we finally get a cab. While I'm not allowed to walk him down doormanless side streets, his after-school activities routinely maroon us in desolate, cabless neighborhoods where any minute I'll be forced to choose between Grayer or my life. I haul him into the taxi, throw the tennis racket in after him, and pull the rest of the equipment in with me.
67th and Madison, please.
I look at Grove.
How's your head? Any better?
It's okay.
He slows down to a whimper, but it sounds like a whimper with staying power. He was looking the wrong way when the pro turned on the ball feeder. How about golf, G? I think we should try golf. Smaller balls, less damage. He looks up at me with wet eyes. Come here. He leans across the seat and puts his head in my lap. I run my fingers through his hair and play with his ears just like my mom used to do. The motion of the car soothes him, and before we even reach Midtown, he's asleep. He must be wiped. What a different life we'd all be living if he was only allowed to nap. I pull back my raincoat sleeve to look at my watch. What will an extra 15 minutes matter? Driver, can you make a loop up to 110th and then back down the west side and across the 68th Street transverse?
Sure, lady. Whatever you say.
I look out at the window at the gray sky and pull my coat closer around me as round raindrops hit the windshield, still waiting for April showers to feel like they could lead to May flowers. Grover, wake up. We're here. He's a little groggy and wiping his eyes when I press the townhouse's doorbell, the racket slung over my shoulder. Hello? An English voice says from the intercom. Hi, it's Nanny and Grayer. There's no reply. I reach over and press the talk button again. We have a play date with Carter? Really? There's a pause. Well, come on up then. The buzzer sounds and I push the heavy glass door open while Grayer stumbles ahead of me into the marble entrance foyer. Past the grand staircase at the back of the house is a solarium whose long windows reveal a garden. Raindrops steadily fill the stone fountain.
Hello?
A young voice asks. I look up from where I'm wrestling Grayer's coat zipper. A little boy, Grayer's age, with blonde, curly hair, is standing on the landing, his hand looped through the banister, leaning away on a diagonal.
Hi, I'm Carter.
I've never seen this boy before, and realize Grayer hasn't either.
I'm Grayer.
Hello? The same English voice calls down the stairs. Just leave your gear anywhere and come on up. I throw our wet coats on the floor and drop our gear beside it. Go ahead, G. He runs up after Carter. I begin my ascent. On the first floor, I pass a Venetian living room at the front of the house and a deco dining room at the back. As I reach the second floor, featuring the Empire master bedroom and a man's study done in the African vein, lots of antelope heads and a zebra skin rug, I'm audibly panting. I chug up to the third level, which has a large mural of Winnie the Pooh painted on the landing, and I'm guessing it is Carter's floor. Keep going, I hear encouragement being shouted from above.
You're almost there, Nanny, lazy.
Thanks, G, I call up. I finally drag myself sweating to the fourth floor, which has been opened up into a large family room come kitchen. Hi, I'm Lizzie. Stairs a bit much, eh? Want some water? That would be lovely. I'm Nanny. I extend the hand that isn't clutching my abdomen. She's maybe a few years older than me, wearing a gray flannel skirt, blue sky Oxford shirt, and a navy cardigan tied around her shoulders. I recognize her as part of the community of high-class British imports who regard this as a noble profession, requiring training and certification, and they dress accordingly. The boys have already run off to the corner where a village of plastic play school houses are set up, to play what sounds like Sack the Serfs. Here, Lizzie hands me the water. I thought we'd just let them blow off steam for an hour and then plunk them in front of the J-U-N-G-L-E-B-O-O-K. Sounds great. I don't know what I'm going to do when Carter learns to spell. Learns sign language, I guess. I stare at the rococo kitchen cabinets, the distressed French tiles, the egg and dart moldings. This is an amazing house. Do you live in? I have a little flat on the top floor. I look over at the stairs and realize that, yes, there is another floor. You must be in amazing shape. Try doing it with a knackered 4-year-old in your arms. I laugh. I've never met Carter before. Where does he go to school?
Country Day,
she says, taking my empty glass.
Oh, I used to look after the Gleason girls. They went there. It's a nice place.
Yeah.
Carter, get off him!
I look over just as Grayer is released from a death grip.
Wow, Carter, how'd you do that? Show me, show me!
Grayer's eyes are alight at the discovery. Oh, great, I say. Now he'll be leaping out to put me in a chokehold. A swift kick to the groin and they're down in no time, she says, winking at me. Where has she been this whole year? I could have had a playground buddy.
Hey, you want to see the terrace?
Sure. I follow her out to a stone balcony overlooking the garden and the back of the brownstones on the other side of the block. We stand under the awning as the rain splatters the tips of our shoes. It's beautiful, I say, my breath coming in little puffs of vapor. It's a real 19th-century enclave. She nods.
Cigarette?
She asks.
You can smoke?
Sure. Carter's mom doesn't mind? Please. I take one. So how long have you been working here? I ask as she strikes the match.
About a year. It's a little nuts,
but compared to the other jobs I've had.
I mean, when you live in, you know.
She shakes her head, blowing smoke into the drizzle. They run your life while you live in a closet off the kitchen. At least here, I've got a great space.
Those round windows?
She points with her cigarette.
That's my bedroom, and that there is my sitting room. And my bath has a jacuzzi. It was meant to be a guest suite, but, well, guests are a little out of the question.
Wow, not a bad deal.
Well, it's full-time duty.
Are they nice? She starts laughing. I guess he's not bad. He's never really around, which makes her a bit off a rocker. That's why they needed a live-in.
Yoo-hoo! Lizzie, are you out there?
I freeze, trying not to exhale, a tiny trail of smoke escaping from my nostrils.
Yeah, Mrs. Milton, we're outside.
She casually stubs out her cigarette on the balustrade and throws it into the garden. I shrug and follow suit.
There you are, she says as we come back into the kitchen.
Mrs. Milton, a Mattel blonde, sits on the floor in a peach silk robe, sniffing and delicately wiping her nose, while the boys run around her.
Now who's this?
Her voice has a slight southern lilt.
That's Grayer, Lizzie says.
And I'm Nanny. I extend my hand.
Oh, Grayer. Grayer, I saw your mama at Swifty's. Well, every time we're at Lottie Burke, we keep saying we have to get our boys together. And then there she was having lunch, and we said, well, we just have to make a plan, and here you are, Grayer.
She picks him up and holds him upside down, in fluffy mules, no less. Grayer seems to be trying to make eye contact with me, clearly uncertain how to respond to this outpouring of affection. She puts him down.
Lizzie, Lizzie, darling, don't you have a date tonight?
Yeah, but
shouldn't you be getting ready? It's only 4.
Nonsense. Go relax. I want to spend some time with my Carter.
Besides, Nanny can help me.
She hunkers down.
Hey, boys, you want to make a cake? We have cake mix, right, Lizzie?
Always.
Great.
Her silk robe billows out behind her as she crosses to the kitchen, revealing long, tanned, and very naked legs. I realize as she turns that she is completely au naturel beneath her robe.
Now let's see. Eggs? Milk?
She pulls everything out and sets it on the counter.
Lizzie, where are the pans?
In the drawer under the oven. She grabs my wrist and whispers,
don't let her burn herself.
Before I have a chance to ask if and why this is likely, she's run upstairs to her room.
I like chocolate cake,
Grayer says, casting his vote.
We only have vanilla sugar.
Mrs. Milton holds up the red box.
I like vanilla,
says Carter.
At my birthday, Grayer continues, I had a cake. It looked like a football and it was really, really big.
Woohoo! Let's have some music. She pushes a button on the Bang & Olufsen stereo above the counter. And Donna Summer comes blaring out.
Come on, Sugar Pie, come and dance with Mama. Carter shakes his arms and bobs his knees. Grayer starts off slowly with a head wiggle, but by on the radio, he lets the jazz hands fly. Looking good, boys! She takes a hand of each, and the three of them bounce through all of Donna Summer's greatest hits, right up through She Works Hard for the Money, while I quietly start cracking eggs and greasing the pan. I put the cake in the oven and turn around in search of an oven timer to see Mrs. Milton twirling near the play school village. I have a Miss Clavel feeling. I'm just going to go use the powder room, I say to no one in particular. I open every door off the pantry, attempting to locate a bathroom. Turning on the light in a small room, I discover four mannequins in a V configuration wearing sequined gowns, each with a banner across her middle. Miss Tucson, Miss Arizona, Miss Southwest, Miss Southern States. There are tiaras and scepters, framed news clippings, and a baton, all carefully displayed in glass cases. I slowly inspect every dress, each sash, and then go over to the far wall, which is covered in glossy framed photographs of Mrs. Milton, the Vegas showgirl, which I guess is where you go after being Miss Southern States. There is row after row of photographs of her in various sequined costumes and headdresses, wearing thick makeup and false lashes. In each, she's sitting on some celebrity's lap, everyone from Tony Bennett to Rod Stewart. And then I see it, halfway down the wall, almost hidden, a snapshot of Mrs. Milton in a short, skin-tight white dress, Mr. Milton, his eyes rolled back in his head, and the preacher. The caption on the frame reads, "The All-Night Chapel of Love, August 12th, 1990. I turn out the light and find the bathroom. When I come back out, Mrs. Milton is peering forlornly in the oven.
"You did it."
"Yes, ma'am."
I just said ma'am. "You did it."
She seems to be having trouble absorbing the information. "It's almost done," I offer reassuringly.
"Oh, goody. Who wants frosting?"
She pulls six tubs of different flavored frosting out of the fridge.
"Carter, get the food dye."
Grayer and Carter mambo over. She grabs sprinkles, silver balls, and candy confetti from the cupboards and starts squirting the food dye Carter hands her directly into the tubs.
"Ooh-wee!"
She's laughing uncontrollably now. "Mrs. Milton," I say, standing back with apprehension, "I think it's time for Grayer and me to go."
"Tina!"
"I beg your pardon?"
"Call me Tina. You can't leave,"
she calls over her shoulder as she scoops a fingerful of frosting into her mouth.
"I don't want to go home," Grayer panics, his fists tightly clenching a bouquet of plastic spoons. "See? Nobody has to leave. Now, who wants frosting?"
She reaches into two of the containers, pulling out two handfuls of frosting and catapulting them, one at Carter, one at Grayer.
"Frosting fight!"
She hands a tub to each boy, and the frosting starts flying. I try to duck behind the island, but Tina hits me squarely across the chest. I haven't been in a food fight since middle school, but I grab a tub of pink and fling a small handful at her, just paying her back for the sweater. And then I'm out. They are laughing hysterically. The boys roll on the floor, mushing frosting in each other's hair. Tina grabs some silver balls and sprinkles them over the boys like snow.
"What's going on down there?"
Lizzie's stern English voice calls from upstairs.
"Ooh, we're in trouble," she says. "Carter, I think we're in trouble."
They all crack up again. Lizzie comes into the kitchen in her terry bathrobe and slippers.
"Oh, my God."
She looks around. There is frosting everywhere, dripping off the French tiles and the topiaries lining the window.
"Oh, Lizzie, we're just having fun. Loosen up. Don't be so British."
"Tina," Lizzie uses my Wicked Witch voice, "go get in the tub." Tina looks crestfallen and starts to cry, sinking in her robe and revealing a bit too much of her impressive superstructure.
"But I... we were...
We were just having fun. Please don't tell John. You had fun, didn't you, boys?
I had fun. Don't be sad. Grayer gently touches her head, patting bits of pink frosting into her blonde hair. Tina looks at Lizzie and wipes her nose on her sleeve.
Okay, okay.
She hunkers in front of the boys.
Mama's gonna go take a bath, okay?
She pats each one on the head and then walks over to the banister.
You come back real soon, Grayer, you hear?
She murmurs to herself as she disappears down the stairs.
Goodbye, Tina,
Grayer shouts. And with a little backward wave, she's gone. I wait for Carter to protest, but he's quiet. We strip the boys, and Lizzie gives me a pair of Carter's pajamas and a plastic bag for Grayer's clothes. We put on the Jungle Book and try to clean up the kitchen. Damn it, Lizzie says, scrubbing on her hands and knees. Mr. Milton might come home tonight, and if he sees this, he'll send her back to Hazelden, and it's terrible for Carter, her disappearing for weeks at a time when his father travels so much. It absolutely devastates him. Lizzie wrings out the sponge. He asked me to go with her, to Hazelden, so I could, you know, figure out when she would use again and intervene. What's she on? I ask, although I already have a pretty good idea. Coke, alcohol, prescription stuff when she can't sleep. How long has this been going on for? Oh, years, she says, squeezing out her sponge into the bucket. I think since she came to New York. She fell in with some really posh junkies, celebrities and the like. He leaves her alone here all the time, so it's hard for her. But there's no prenup, so I guess he's just waiting for her to OD. Well, this certainly puts panties in perspective. I know I should quit, but my visa extension is attached to this job. If I leave Carter, it means going home, and I really want to stay in America. I just wring out my sponge, not knowing what to say. Here, why don't you guys push off? I'll finish this. You sure? Oh, yeah. Tomorrow, it'll be something else. Grayer and Carter are loath to be parted,